Hi.
Yo, yo, hey. This is Speech.
Yes, hi, how you doing? This is Navdi. I'm out here in the UK.
What's up, brother? Yes, good to talk to you, man. Good to talk to you.
Yes.
I'm here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay. Okay. Are you driving or are you off somewhere?
I'm not driving. My daughter and my wife are driving. I'm just chilling in the back seat.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, it's... Yeah. You know, it's not often that we get to, as I said, it's really good the fact that you guys who have been in mainstream music culture since the early 90s and are still making music and stuff. But
sure.
One of the things about our show, Halftime Chat, is that we've got an international audience of R&B fans from around the world. And, you know, they always nice. Love to hear the stories from our favorite groups and also just see what you guys are up to now. But we always like to go to the beginning. Because we're international, it's good to know where you were. So you personally were born and raised and then we start from there.
Yeah, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the Midwest here in the United States.
Okay. And
that's where I was born and raised. And then I spent my summers in Tennessee with my grandmother. So I got a lot of sort of rural south, down south energy flowing in my veins as well. And then I got, I moved to Atlanta in 1987, and that's where Arrested Development started, is in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
So I've been here in Atlanta ever since.
Okay. I went to college in Mequon, Concordia University, Mequon.
Now, Mequon is a beautiful, beautiful town.
So from 93 to 98 I lived in Milwaukee with Mequon and then subsequently Milwaukee, so I know the area. I didn't realize you were from I knew you were born there. I didn't realize you actually grew up and stuff there.
Definitely.
In those early days then, how did you get into music as a kid growing up in the Midwest?
The Midwest is an interesting place because we're not on the coast. We're not the East Coast. We're not the West Coast.
Yeah.
And we liked music from everywhere. So my dad owned a nightclub and he would get promotional records. And at this time I was 12, 13 years old. Yeah. And so he used to ask me to listen to the records to decide what I thought should be played at the club.
What?
And so I did. And I listened to everything from, you know, rock music to soul and hip hop. So, so I fell in love with music. I fell in love with DJing. And I started DJing at age 13 at the nightclub for the adults, you know, at night.
Wow.
And that's sort of where I cut my teeth as a DJ and really like learning musicality.
Yeah.
And so, it was through my dad's nightclub that I really learned all that stuff.
Then at that time, then I know as a DJ, you're learning the music and the different vibes and stuff, but what about the actual performance side? Was that ever something that you thought about picking up, or you just enjoyed that sort of mixing the records?
So at first it was more about mixing the records, but I was pretty popular. So I was doing a lot of DJ sets for Milwaukee. And then I started a rap group called Attack in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And we were probably the most noted and famous hip hop group in Milwaukee at the time. This was in the 80s, like the early 80s.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think I cut my teeth like performance wise, you know, doing that kind of shows and, you know, just doing hip hop and, you know, learning from some of the greats, you know, Run DMC and LL and UTFO and Houdini and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so from that early age then, what was it for you then? Was it just a passway time? You were thinking about school and stuff, or what was it?
Nah, man, this was like literally my number one priority was music, you know, in lieu of sports, because I used to run track when I was in grade school, but I stopped because of music. Like, you know, everything I was focused on was music related. I sucked at school because of it. Like, you know, I don't know how the system works there, but here I had a 0.9 average in high school. I was really, really, really bad. And so F basically, which is how we grade it over here. So it was pretty, pretty bad, but obviously, you know, music worked out for me and I was grateful. And I, you know, once I started, it's funny, once I started learning about Black history and Black power and Black Panthers and Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X, that actually helped me to do better in school because I had a reason to be excellent. Like prior to that, I think I was sort of disillusioned with the whole education system and stuff like that. So,
yeah. I guess just when you weren't doing that great in grade in your school and you were into the music, what was your parents? How did they, I mean, were they encouraging the music or they were like, no, what was the situation?
No, I think, you know, I was really blessed because my parents very much encouraged the music. My mom, because like my mom's a super educated woman, very, very great speaker, great educator. And I think she realized quickly that I wasn't going to be on that same path. So she was like, okay, at least he could do music. Let me support him on that. My dad, he was more of a street dude. And he saw me as just talented with sort of A&Ring, you know, good records to play at the club. He saw that. And he also, I thought, when I think about it, I think he realized that was a way for him to stay close to me too. So keep me off the streets. Milwaukee, as you well know, I'm a Milwaukee, not Mequon, of course, is a rough town. You know what I mean? It's a rough town for Black people. It's literally statistically one of the worst places for Black men to grow up in. So Mequon, on the other hand, is
Black, yeah.
I love Mequon, man. But so you know, trying to keep me off the streets, I think he realized that music was a way to, you know, to keep me motivated and inspired.
Then what about the, because I mentioned, okay, so my family are Nigerian. So I was born in England, went to high school in Nigeria, but then went to college in the US. So by the time I moved to the US in 93, I had a sort of a rounded understanding of my heritage. And so nice. I had a very different understanding about some civil rights and stuff, because I actually moved to Alabama. But for yourself...
Wow.
Yeah, so Selma, Alabama, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me say one thing to my wife right quick. I hope y'all look for apartments, too.
Yeah, we saw.
Okay, gotcha. Go ahead, bro.
Yeah, Selma, Alabama. So actually, the mayor of Selma, when I moved there in 93, was the same guy who was the mayor when they did the march across Selma.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
So I moved to Selma hearing about all this stuff and fascinated, but I wasn't deterred about, you know, the racism stuff, because I think I just had a very different sort of focus.
Sure.
But, you know, one of the things that you mentioned was about the, and one of the things about your music has always been about, you know, empowerment, very similar. You mentioned about the Public Enemy and probably African Bambaataa and stuff. How, because that wasn't very popular, because a lot of people were thinking about money and stuff. How did you hold on to that element of social consciousness and think, you know, it may not be the most popular and commercially viable, but it's something I believe passionate about?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, it was two things. One is that my mother and father were activists.
Wow.
So my mom owns the largest Black newspaper in Wisconsin. It's called the Milwaukee Community Journal. It's still rolling to this day. And so my mom owns that. So every morning at breakfast as a family, we talk about Black issues and things that are going on in the community and trying to figure out ways to solve stuff. We would talk about that. So that was just a family tradition. But then second of all, Milwaukee, the disparities between Black and white in Milwaukee the contrast is very strong. So like you would see the oppression, you know, you could see it pretty clearly. Mm. You know, there was no middle class, upper middle class Black neighborhoods in Milwaukee. It was like,
yeah.
You know, So I think that it was very just on my mind, the disparities and the problems that were happening in the United States that's why I really wanted to do music that addressed that, because it was so like stark, you know?
Yeah, but as I said, we spoke about the commercial elements of it, because if you would know, there's people like KRS-One, and stuff,
yeah.
You know, they had an impact, but they weren't making the money that Nas and the rest were making. And so, was that ever cross your mind? Was it no? And this is my truth that I'm learning, and I need to speak it out. And whether it pays the bills or not, it isn't something that I'm going to be worried about. So, did you ever think about that in those early days?
I heard you, but you were breaking up a little bit. I'm probably breaking up too. I'm sorry about that. If I am.
Okay.
So no, yeah, no. I mean, I think. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. The good news is, back in the late 80s, early 90s, conscious hip hop really did well. I mean, it was a lot of money being made. You know, Public Enemy sold millions of records per album. You know, KRS-One was touring pretty well, doing quite well. You know, so I think for me, although money wasn't a motivation, you did at least at that time period in hip hop have this sense that if you were excellent at what you did, you had a chance to at least get out into the mainstream's consciousness, because Public Enemy was a mainstream group at one point.
Yeah.
You know, and KRS-One was very noted, you know, like back in those days, on the radio, you would play a Public Enemy, a KRS-One, a MC Hammer, a Two Live Crew, all in the same show. And same difference with touring, you know, tours were mixed like that, where it was MC Hammer, who was straight up popular, and then Public Enemy, who was more underground, but still were selling some units. And Two Live Crew, who was very much controversial, but still popular. So, you know, you had a lot of diversity on the mediums that were promoting the music. So that was good, you know? And so, but I wasn't thinking about that too much though, to be honest. I think I was more so focused on just getting the message out there. And that's the other beauty of that time period. We were way more focused on fundamental changes.
Okay. And so when you started, did you go from Attack, and why did you switch that up to Arrested Development?
Yeah. That's a great question. You know, Attack was my first sort of foray into being into a hip hop group. And at that time, I didn't know myself really. I was about 14, 15 years old.
Okay.
And I was just imitating what I thought was great hip hop. So imitating the styles of, or the vibes of Run DMC and LL and Houdini and UTFO, that type of thing. So, but as I, you know, when I got to Atlanta in 1987, I was 18, and I wanted to do something different. Plus, my consciousness really kicked in. I think hearing Public Enemy's first record, Yo Bum Rush the Show, gave me a real sense of, wow, there's a revolution going on here, and it's different. And, you know, KRS-One had an element of that in his music the whole time. But
yeah,
unlike KRS-One, Public Enemy was a little bit more straightforward with it. Like, KRS-One sort of mixed the two. He would sort of, you know, like sort of present himself as a gangster slash conscious dude.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, at least. And Public Enemy, on the other hand, was more straightforward, conscious, especially by their second album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. So, yeah. So anyway, so that's, I think I sort of got permission by other groups and artists that were successful doing it, you know, gave me sort of permission to be more wholehearted and steadfast about it.
You mentioned moving to Atlanta, and this was what, by the late 80s?
Yeah, I moved to Atlanta in 87.
So, you know, and I'm saying this because now Atlanta's now a mecca for black business and music industry and film industry and everything, but, you know, it wasn't until The Face really set up shop there, then Def Jam South, you know, there was nothing really in Atlanta. I remember from Selma moving to Atlanta in 93, 94, you know, houses were cheap. There was nothing much happening until the Olympics in 96. So why Atlanta in 88? Why move to Atlanta at that stage instead of New York or LA?
You know, it's funny. Atlanta, two reasons. One is, three reasons. I sucked at school. And the only school I could get into, the only college, was the Art Institute of Atlanta. Second reason is, I love the South. Like, I fell in love with the South, spending summers with my grandmother in Tennessee.
Okay.
So that was the second reason. The third reason is, black people, even in the early and late 80s, in Atlanta were thriving, unlike anywhere else in the entire United States. I mean, there was black middle class all over the place. I mean, everywhere. There was black businesses thriving. There was black consciousness and activism thriving. So there was this sense that it was like a little Africa, you know, in Atlanta. And so all of those were reasons why I wanted to pass this sort of energy.
It's true. I mean, I remember, they had police chiefs and mayors and congress people. It was, you know, and probably some of the most beautiful black people you'd see. And they had Morehouse, Spelman, Clark Atlanta. Actually, I had the opportunity to go to Clark Atlanta or Milwaukee, and I just thought that if I wanted to get a good education, I probably needed to go to the Midwest and focus on education as opposed to stay in Atlanta.
Instead of partying.
Partying. So that's why I moved to Milwaukee. And you know, you're right about the Midwest. I lived in Alabama. I lived in LA. And, you know, to anyone who's watching from Wisconsin, it was a beautiful time, but it was probably the hardest time I experienced as a black person in my life.
Wow.
It was, I just felt that if in the South, staying in a race in Selma, Alabama, I felt more at home because I knew if people didn't like me, they would be honest. If people liked you, they were honest. You felt like you knew where you stood. And same in LA. But when I moved to Wisconsin, it was like, wow, I can't tell. And so I didn't feel as comfortable living in the Midwest. And as I said, Mequon is great. But that's the one thing I always tell people, that the Midwest was probably one of my challenging times living in and spending the 10 years in the States.
Totally get that.
So how did then, when you went to Atlanta, then how did you think about being a recording artist while you were in college? Or was it just, did you then think about how did you get the deal and all that? Or in those early days, what was the thought?
Well, you know, definitely in the early days, you couldn't get too far without a record deal. But it was my top priority. You know, when I came to Atlanta, even above schooling, to some extent, I really wanted to start a group. And, you know, the first day I got to the school, I put up a flyer saying that I'm looking for a DJ, you know, and at that time I decided to start rapping. So I was sort of recreating myself in a sense. And, you know, I was looking for a DJ, and that was the first day. So yeah, I was definitely determined to try to do something cool in the Atlanta world. And before LaFace, before Def Jam South was Arrested Development.
So when did you get the name then? When did you think about the name of Arrested Development and what it really meant?
You know, back in those days, I was motivated by groups like Fishbone or even Public Enemy, A Tribe Called Quest. They were very conceptual names, De La Soul. And I wanted to have a name that sounded important and unique. And so a friend of mine, a white friend of mine, very good friend of mine named Shy Boy, had a rock group, a punk rock group called Arrested Development. And they ended up breaking up. And he said, you know, man, we're broke up, we're done. And I was like, dude, can I use that name for something I'm trying to do? And he said, yeah. And that was it. I just used the name. And what it meant to us was, basically, black people have been in a state of arrested development, and our music was the reminder of what we're fighting against, which is arrested development. We're fighting against that halted growth. Start getting us to rise up, you know.
So by the time you if you think about the late 80s getting into the 90s, those music had, you know, we'd moved on slightly from Public Enemy and KRS-One. There was a little bit, there's a difference, you know. We had West Coast talking, you know, little G, their gangster rap, you know, still saying the same sort of things, but in a very different vibe. Then we had the guys out of New York. I'm thinking about Nas and others having the vibe, the music, gangster premiere, the music was changing, and not as hardcore as what Public Enemy and stuff were doing. And so our listening habits were changing, and then we had the new Jack Swing, so there was the party side of things. Did you then think, wow, have I come too late? So what was your idea about how to get that message and form your music?
You know, for me, it was more of an issue of we need to have diversity in the messages in hip hop. It can't just be gang members and, you know, selling drugs and, you know, strip clubs. It's got to be all of that because that's part of the Black experience in America, but it's got to be revolution. It's got to be spirituality. It's got to be elders and young people together. It's got to be men and women together. It's got to be talking about family and community and communal success and, you know, self-determination success. So these things were very needed. So to me, the lack of seeing it is what brought about more urgency to make it happen with us.
Okay. And then how did you then, okay, so you got yourself, okay, this is our music. We know what we're going to do. We've got our lane. Then how do you go about looking for somebody who's going to believe in that and say, we'll give you a record deal because I don't know if we're going to sell money on this, but I believe in the message.
Yeah, definitely was a process, you know, going through a lot of fake people and people that were, you know, just trying to use us or what have you. But finally, we ran across Michael Malden, who ironically is Jermaine Dupri's father.
Of Columbia.
Yep, of Columbia Records. And at that time, he wasn't with Columbia. He was just a manager, a striving manager trying to make it, you know. And he loved us. He loved his son, of course. And so he started managing us, and he was managing his son.
Okay.
And at the time, his son put out Crisscross. And I think right before Crisscross dropped, Arrested Development dropped, you know, our record. So he was the one that got us the record deal, well, at least connected us to the record label and got them to hear us and get interest in us. But I will say, we got turned down a lot. I mean, all the record labels turned us down except for one, and we ended up going with that label. And I'm glad we did. They did a great job on that first record in particular. So, yeah, it was a good look.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said, that's I mean, because internationally, you know, the if most people didn't understand the message, they enjoy the music. You know, it felt a bit of jazz, a bit of storytelling, a bit of folk. It was very different and unique. So you got a lot of people not feeling guilty about anything, but just enjoying the song and the stuff. Did you have to change the music with the label? Did they think, okay, we understand the message, but we need it to be a little bit softer, or was this from Tennessee and all this? Was this how you envisioned it from day one, and it was like no change?
No change. Yeah, not at all. At that point in the hip hop industry, and in the relation to record labels, they were totally confused,
okay,
befuddled about how to put out hip hop and how to make it successful. So they relied 100% on us as artists to guide them as to how to market this. How do you get this to radio? How, you know, we would have marketing meetings, and the rest of development, especially me, was in those marketing meetings trying to guide them as to how to promote this music because we knew the hip hop world. So at that time, they knew they wanted to make money from it, but they didn't know how to actually market it. They later would learn how to do hip hop, but unfortunately in the most degrading ways. And actually that was a downside for us as people, and in my opinion, for hip hop in general. But yeah, so yeah, but in that time period, it definitely was us guiding the ship.
So, I mean, when you came out, because it was probably around the same time with Naughty by Nature, that type of sort of difference.
Yep.
And okay. But how was it then for you, the business side of things? Because as I said, you really focused on the music side, but understanding here's a standard contract and all that stuff. Did you educate yourself on that well enough before you got involved?
No, not well enough. You know, we had lawyers. Like, I went to the Art Institute of Atlanta, as I said, and our first lawyer that negotiated our first contract was one of my professors.
Okay.
He sucked at negotiating contracts. He sucked. So he gave us the worst deal. I would learn later that it was the worst deal. But at the time, I thought that was shrewd of us because he was our professor, but he didn't know nothing about signing the major label deals. Mind you, a lot of people in Atlanta weren't signing major label deals at the time. You know? So, you know, I'll give him that. But as a lawyer, he should have known better, but he didn't. And so, yeah, our agreement sucked. And not to mention, at this time, we're 18, 19, 20 years old and very young, very wet behind the ears as far as wisdom is concerned, especially regarding the music industry. So, you know, it was a bunch of mistakes made and things of that nature. You know?
Okay. Yeah, you know, I've probably interviewed over 50 R&B artists from KG, from Naughty by Nature to Jodeci, SWE, and 112. And I think Slim from 112 says, you know, in the 90s, it all happened to all of us. You know, it was almost, Jodeci says, look, we knew how to make music, but we knew zero about the business side. And I think it was hard for us as fans to hear this because we know you sell 6 million albums and we know that's, you know, generating over 100 million. And so we all assumed you guys were just rocking, rolling, rich and we're celebrating that and you know, not knowing that as creators of you know, you focus so much on the creative side that you expect somebody else to manage the business side so you can become creators.
Yeah, I think in our case, there's a few things. One is even our management wasn't very experienced yet, you know?
Okay.
And all of us were sort of striving and thriving to make it at the same time. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, you know, I'm the producer of the music. I write the lyrics. So I made money, you know what I mean? But not nearly what later hip hop artists would be able to make by striking better deals and learning from basically the mistakes of us, you know, not just my group, but people from our era.
Yeah. When it came to the video concept, especially when like when you come out with Tennessee, did you get involved with that or did you, and the visual element of how you want to portray the group?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like my dream was always to represent the rural South because at that time in hip hop, it wasn't done. So, you know, you didn't have any huge successful groups from the South, maybe the Ghetto Boys at best. And, you know, 2 Live Crew was from the coast of Miami. So it's just a different energy altogether, more palm trees and more of a coastal energy.
Yeah.
At that time, hip hop was really West Coast, you know, and East Coast. So, you know, we wanted to do something 100% different. My goal was to shoot us, you know, in the rural South and connect that rural lifestyle to hip hop. And I'm glad we did it. I thought that video, especially Tennessee, was one of our best videos, just the stylistic approach and black and white. And to me, it looks like a photo album come to life type of thing.
And it did help. As I said, it's, you know, it's one thing to make conscious music, but it's another thing to be able to reach a wide audience so that people can listen and hear. And if you alienate the masses and just focus on the core group who says, yeah, we know about this and that's cool. But others like, wow, we didn't realize this was happening. What can we do? How can we change? And I think that's the power of what you guys were able to do is to say, look, even though we've got our community, but we need to let everyone else know.
I agree.
Yeah. You know, so that was really powerful. Now, a lot of us will always say, this old guy, Baba OJ, how was he part of the group? Was it just like a gimmick? What was the idea with him?
You know, to be honest, I learned that from Jamaican culture. I went to Jamaica, saw older artists in their 60s rocking music and young women and men in their 18, 19 were dancing to it and having a great time to it. And I didn't used to see that a lot in America. So I realized that there was this different sort of culture of ours as Black people, people of African descent, that we weren't really representing well in America. And so Bob OJ was sort of, I wouldn't call it a gimmick, but I would call it a strategy to try to bring images of culture and family and community to hip hop. You know what I mean? So Baba was that elder that I felt like we were missing as a people in America in particular, maybe around the world, but definitely in America. We're missing that part of it, that puzzle piece.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned that my heritage is Nigerian. So, you know, I know my great-grandfather, where he's from, and we're all very much, they say it takes a village to raise a child. So pretty much, even though you have your parents, you have uncles and aunties and all involved in your life, you can't just go left and right. And so for us, it was easy to identify and see this. I've seen barbecues and family reunions, but in America, but it's not the same, because we revere our elders. We like to listen to their stories, like to hear about back in the day what happened, and we learned this and those riddles and the tales about, you know, why you don't use your left hand to take stuff. You know, even now, most Africans, if you ask them, if you hand them stuff, they'll always use their right hand, just because 200 years ago, when there was no toilet roll, the left hand was used. And so that's passed down as a sign of respect. So those are things that we probably could see that and identify, like, oh, you've got elders who generally stand for wisdom.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Baba was real with that. Like, his wisdom was very real. He traveled throughout Africa on his own, and before the group got famous. And, you know, he was just a very learned dude and a very, just a searcher of knowledge, a seeker of knowledge, you know, just always amongst the homeless people, always helping the homeless here in Atlanta, traveling throughout Africa on his own dime, and, you know, just learning the languages, learning the cultures, learning the history. So he's a very great guy. You know, he passed away in 2018, but he's just he was a fantastic elder.
Now, the other thing that you guys did, which was, you know, apart from being the first hip hop group to win a Grammy for Best New Artist, which is an astounding achievement, because in those early 90s, hip hop was still, you know, people were still not sure about it. And especially the Grammys, which, you know, we do have our own reservations about what we think about the Grammys. But to win it, what kind of achievement did you feel that was?
It was a big deal. And I'll tell you why. I was very aware of the downplaying of hip hop that the Grammys was doing. Very aware. And at the same time, like most people my age, we grew up watching the Grammys. It was the epitome of the music industry, as far as that's the highest height that you could reach. If you were on that stage, or if you got a Grammy, that was the best hats off to, it was a huge deal to win. At the same time, representing hip hop, you know, we wanted to make sure that it was televised. Ours was televised. The year before us, I think, was televised. I think it was Naughty by Nature. And I think it was televised. So, you know, we were seeing progress with the Grammys. And so, we didn't boycott it or anything. We were very excited about winning two, actually. We won two Grammys and nominated for another for our second album, Zynga Lamadumi.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we move forward then, because you mentioned about how the labels got an understanding about the hip hop, you know, start pouring millions into labels like Cash Money and you know, Death Row and stuff, because they saw that this was selling, and so they were pushing that. And any social conscious music was less, getting probably less budgets and promotions. What happened with you guys? I mean, when, you know, did you notice that the labels weren't as keen at pushing, or was it?
Oh, definitely, bro. It was an intentional switch of direction to promoting ignorance in the music and not consciousness, number one. Number two, at that time, companies were consolidating. They were becoming huge conglomerates. The laws changed in 1996, which allowed companies to basically, you know, own up as many competitors as they could. And then also, they were investing in a lot of the private prisons at the time. So there was numerous incentives for labels to promote ignorance, which would lead to prison, which would lead to profits for the prison system and the privatized prison systems in particular. So there was numerous reasons, not to mention conscious music is not really big on materialism and consumerism. So as America in general started relying more and more on consumerism as opposed to producing products, then, you know, hip hop music, which was fastly becoming the most popular music in the world, you know, it benefited the whole consumer driven, you know, marketing and strategies to not have conscious music on the dock, you know.
Now, I heard when I interviewed Donnell Jones, he as from an R&B artist who spoke those things about love and relationships, he says he felt there was an agenda by the labels and the powers that be that they actually started to eliminate and push music that focused on love, and that there was the deliberate and knowing that if you're not speaking and spreading love and romance, you're sowing other seeds. And you're almost saying the same thing. I didn't realize there was a merger. There was a lot of change that allowed labels to merge. We just knew they were doing so. But you then started to believe that they actually, there was some links with the prison system and to try. So then how did you guys then?
It's documented. It's documented. You know, it's documented that these labels invested in these particular companies. BlackRock Inc. is one of them. It's documented that they own large amounts of stock and stakes in these companies, these privatized prisons. And so, yeah, it's definitely an agenda that was purposely done. You know, now I will say part of it was Black people's fault. You know, a lot of the guys from the streets of hip hop were pushing to try to make sure that the street sound wasn't getting drowned out by conscious music and by love music and so on and so forth, you know. So they were really pushing as well and trying to make money. It was all about money for them. It was a power, sort of a grab bag type of situation. So, you know, that happened as well.
Wow. Because I we know that you guys were very big about donating money, not just to whether it's homeless charities or even the ANC and stuff. Where did that come from? That sense of, you know, we've made this money, even though we could have should have been making more, but the money we did make, we're going to give it out. I mean, that's very rare. You'd see people doing that type of stuff because you think about securing yourself, your grandchildren, and then whatever spare change, you say, okay, I can do a little charity here for tax reasons and stuff. That's really very brave, because I would say it's brave, but also very almost putting your money where your mouth is. I mean, whose idea was that?
It was my idea, but, you know, I'm a revolutionary. At the end of the day, I believe in changing things for our people, you know. We've been through enough pain. We've been through enough suffering. So for me, it was priority number one to do that. And then number two, I believe in Pan-Africanism. So for me, like donating to the ANC or donating to other African organizations, to me was part of all of us rising up together. You know, Africa has been exploited as well. So to me, there was a need for us to understand our identity back to Africa.
Yeah.
And there was a need to unite with various causes, because at the end of the day, we're all in this together. Mm. And at the end of that day, we're all in this together, including people of every other ethnicity. We're all human beings at the end of the day. So there was a need to try to help everybody out as much as we could, you know?
Yeah. But then I do wonder how much when you are, you know, because I know you got involved with Spike Lee in a Malcolm X movie, which was a very powerful movie, and even the soundtrack was very powerful. But I then wonder when you're so, you know, you've sold many records, your household name, do the labels see you as, look, this you know, this guy, these guys could mess things up. You know, people are thinking too much. Let's drown them out. I mean, did you, let's just sort of quiet them down a bit, Did you feel that? Because some labels are, you know, still, we've got something here, let's promote.
Definitely. I mean, just think about the songs. I mean, we're talking like in our song Revolution, for instance, you know, we're talking about, do you want us to go get a gun now? Do you, you know, you don't like seeing people run around now, yet and still you want to live like 90210 while we scream freedom. You know, like we're threatening, if change isn't happening, we're threatening revolutionary, you know, fighting, and we're threatening rebellion. And that's an Arrested Development tune, not to mention a Public Enemies tune, you know, or a Paris's tune or X-Clan's tune. So, you know, I think that there was a concerted effort to get that off the table. You know, it was making too many people uncomfortable. So, I definitely, and I, you know, meanwhile, mainstream America not really making fundamental changes that can make the situation a lot better to where we wouldn't have to talk about those kind of things. You know, who wants to, in their early 20s, wants to talk about revolution and fundamental change and, you know, activism? We'd rather hook up with women and go party. And, you know, that's what every young person would rather do. But the social conditions didn't allow people like us to do that.
I mean, you know, we think about what's happening, you know, 2 years ago with George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter, and around the world. I mean, I would say living here in the UK, there's been a consensus change in recognizing that, you know what, we need to make a difference. So even in some of our networks, they're hiring more Black presenters and news readers, and you can see TV programs and hosts. You've seen the change because they recognize that we need to do stuff. So they're not just taking the knee, but they're actually making changes. And it took like the death of George Floyd, which really shocked the world almost. It was almost like an awakening. But you guys were sort of ahead of your time. And I would say, you know, I went to college in the States throughout the 90s, and I was listening to party music, and I, you know, I enjoyed your first album, but I was like, this is a little, you know, too radical for me. It's, and, you know, and it's quite, because as I said, what if it's not promoted to you, you know, if, you know, I'm not going to name other artists, but some of the other artists who were making the bigger money, that's what we're getting fed. And so it's quite easy to just go along with that and say, we love this and love that. And when we're not hearing you guys, we kind of forget. You know, because the first album is on the radio and the city, so this is great. But when we're not seeing you on the radio, seeing you on TV, we kind of forget and we don't go seek because we're not, you know, as I said, we're getting fed. But how did you guys continue to start? I'm sure you keep making music, but back in those days when you don't have a label shipping out the product, what do you guys end up doing?
Well, we broke up from 95 to 2000, and when we got back together in 2000, thank God we had a huge market of Asia that was totally digging our sound, so we were able to really be vital and thrive in the Asia market, in particular Japan, where we're doing sold out tours, sold out shows, sold out records, top 10 records, you know, number one songs, number three on the pop charts, number one on the hip hop charts there. So we had a resurgence, but in a whole nother culture and country.
Yeah.
And then just recently, like, you know, a couple months back, we released an album, a new album called For the F and Love. And that record right now, this week, is number one on two charts. We got, it's number one in Canada on CBC, which is basically the BBC of Canada.
Wow.
And it's number one on Hip Hop Gods Radio, which is a hip hop chart here in the United States. So, you know, it's featuring Big Daddy Kane, Master Ace, Fat Man Scoop, Moni Love, Sugar Hill Gang. I mean, it's packed with great hip hop. So I definitely want all of your viewers and listeners to peep out For the F and Love. It's brand new, it's fire, and so we're bringing the heat, you know.
Are you guys going on tour at all to support the album?
Definitely, Definitely. In fact, we're going to the UK heavy, real heavy, starting in April. So people could go to our website, arresteddevelopmentmusic.com. Say it again, arresteddevelopmentmusic.com. And we got tons of dates throughout the UK, like tons, probably about 20 to 30 dates in the UK alone.
Wow.
So it's going to be crazy. Yeah.
What about in North America? Because the US, because there's still a big following there. Are you going to be?
Yeah. We got dates lined up for the US as well, which is fantastic. More in the UK.
Okay.
But yeah. Can you open this door, Queen?
I'm sorry.
So yeah. So that's like, it's fire. I'm really fired up about coming there too.
Okay. No, yeah. I mean, we'll definitely make sure we get people to the website so they can see. The one question a lot of people have asked is, there was a TV show in America called Arrested Development. Yeah. How did you guys handle the fact that they made a big show using a name that you guys had pretty much made famous?
You know, that was a boss move that they made on that, because we had trademarked the name Arrested Development back in the 90s. So 93, we trademarked it, which means no other company could use it for the similar purposes that we were using it for. So they ignored that trademark, thinking that we weren't going to come after them. And they were wrong. We came after them. We started, getting our lawyers together and sort of strapping up to get them to stop using the name. We ended up settling out of court.
Okay.
And that's how they were able to use the name. Yeah, they tried to do a bum rush on us.
But you think this was a way of silencing the group, or is this that they just came up with a name and didn't even think about it? Or
I think it's probably the latter. I don't think that they were trying to silence us with that particular move. I think it was more of them just for whatever reason liking the name. Now, it's funny because the first episode mentions us, you know, or at least it alludes to us. So, you know. They knew who we were. They were very aware of the fact that we were out there. So, yeah, it's interesting, you know, how all of that went down.
Well, yeah. I think we recently saw you guys on DJ Cassidy's Pass the Mic. And I interviewed DJ Cassidy on Thursday. Yeah. And amazing guy. What was that experience?
Yeah, great dude.
What was that experience like for you guys?
It was great. You know, DJ Cassidy's a good dude, but it's funny, I didn't know him. So, you know, he was trying to get me on the show, but he didn't have my number. And so he was asking various other hip hop stars to reach out to me, and they did. And I was like, I'm good. You know, I'll pass on this joint. I'm good. Oh. And I kept saying, I'll pass. And then one dude finally told me like who all was going to be on it. He's like, yo, LL's on there. you know, EPMD, I forget who all was on the
Run DMC, Rakim.
Run DMC, Rakim. So I was like, yo, wait a minute, I'm sorry. Yeah, I want to do this. So me and Cassidy, we laugh about that now because, of course, we're cool now. But like at the time, I was totally turning him down over and over again.
Yeah.
Like he literally asked me like numerous times. I was like, nah, I'm good.
Wow, yeah. You know, and it was, and the reason why, you know, I brought it up is because one of the things about Volume 2, and I actually did ask Cassie, I said, Cassie, you've done all these episodes, what's your favorite? And he says, Volume 2, the hip-hop one, of all the ones he's done, and this is even when he's promoting the reggae one, he says, because that was his first love, hip-hop, and to see everyone in there, that was his stuff, and watching it back and seeing... Now, the lady, was she from the original group?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Ishii. Yeah, it was me and Ishii rocking on that. And yeah, she's from the original crew.
Okay. Yeah, we saw that. So I didn't get to ask, why did you need a crew? Why didn't you just go solo? Because you were rapping, you're the producer, writer. Why did you think you needed a collective to be part of this?
Like part of Pass the Mic or just in
no,
general?
No. Just in general, when you started as Arrested Development?
Oh, no, nah, man. I never wanted to do a solo joint. You know, it was always, for me, wanting to do a group. It's just, that was the energy I was on. So even though I happened to produce and I happened to write, I really wanted to present a group, you know. And don't get me wrong, the members did stuff that was important, especially in a live show. But of course, even on record, I mean, you know, I can't even imagine a people every day without Tariq echoing my words, you know, I'm resting at the part, mine and my own, my own, you know, and Ishii doing her parts, you know, hit it. I mean, like all of it's relative and all of it's relevant, you know, and it's cool. I definitely wanted a group, put it that way.
Okay. I think finally, what is your thoughts about, you know, we talked about the 90s and stuff, but the way music is now, when you look at music, both hip hop and even R&B, what are your thoughts about how things are?
You know, so much has changed in the music industry. In general, I feel like the youth are still doing some incredible stuff. I think that the stuff that's being promoted the most happens to be the most ignorant. Now, I did a whole documentary called The Nigga Factory. It's on YouTube. It's a mini documentary. It's two parts right now. I'm planning to do three. And I would encourage everybody that is peeping your show to go to YouTube, type in Nigga Factory by Speech. And I go deep into this subject matter, which is, you know, how they use our music, which is very important to us as a people. You know, for Black people, music is more than entertainment. It's communication.
Yeah.
It's scripture. It's therapy. It's all types of things. So, you know, the Nigga Factory addresses how we're being played a lot of times by the music industry. And it demeans us. It demeans us across the planet. It demeans us in our own community to each other.
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned, I keep saying I'm Nigerian, and the Yoruba tribes used to use the drums to mm-hmm. communicate. You know, the talking drums would signal what's happening there, or sounds of war.
Exactly.
We used proverbs to remember stories and to educate.
Yep.
And yeah, and so even the Afrobeats has a very different vibe than when Fela came up with it, because he used it
no doubt, yeah, as totally a message different. Yeah.
To tell people. But now we call it Afrobeats, you know, it's pretty much taking on dancehall and hip hop in a way.
Exactly.
And forgetting what it was meant for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you've got an album out, you're going on tour, so we will be sure to make sure people are aware of that. I always end my interviews by asking my guest that if you were stuck in an elevator and you had a choice of a movie to watch until they got you out, what movie do you request?
Terminator 2 by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay. Terminator 2.
Okay. I'll be back. I actually thought you would say, you know, Malcolm X or something like that, but it's good. Okay.
No, Terminator <That's>, 2.
Yeah, it was a big one. When it comes to music, what's your all-time favorite song?
That's a tough one, bro. I really don't have an all-time favorite. My all-time favorite artist is Prince. So if I had to choose an all-time favorite song, it might be The Ballad of Dorothy Parker by Prince.
Okay, I don't think I've heard that. Okay.
Yeah, it's on his A Sign of the Times album. It's beast. It's fantastic.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you know, it's... It's strange because I was a Michael fan, and mm-hmm. back in those days, they seemed to have been like, well, you can't be a fan mm-hmm. of both. So I never mm-hmm. liked Prince. I just thought he was anti-Michael and stuff. But he felt too rocky for me. I couldn't get into him. But no one mm-hmm. could doubt his talent and stuff. But it's been great to hear from you. And I think the you know, for us, that's why we'd like to sort of hear the backstory, you know, understand the journey, see how things, you know, the successes and also the learning experience and stuff like that. And I guess the final thing is, if you're advising an upcoming artist now based on your journey and where the music industry is now, what advice would you sort of give them?
Be yourself, man. Like, there's a special story that's in each one of you, and each one of us. Don't carbon copy anybody. You know, go out with your own story and be unique. And we're all waiting to hear that. That to me is what the world needs to hear from you. It's your unique view.
That's really good. Are you guys independent? Have you got your own label that you're putting your music out now, or are you
totally independent? I got my own label though. We go out through Vagabond Records, which is my label.
Okay.
We've had this label since 2000, so we've been kicking it like that for a while.
So is it just that you just push out the rest of the development, or do you have your own new artists that you push out as well, or
just the rest of development and solo joints for most of that time? In the early 90s, I produced a group called Gumbo, put them out on Vagabond, and a group called Citizen King that was on Vagabond and left, and a group called El Poos. So early 90s, we had some groups, but since then, it's just been Arrested Development and Speech.
Okay. Well, you know, it's been great. It's been really, really fascinating hearing your story. I'll be sure to make sure people are aware of the album that's out now, to let them know about the tours, and but also the documentary that you have out. We'll put the link in this as it goes out, so people can, because there's a number of people who really are interested in the music industry, and all the conspiracies and things behind it and stuff like that. So we'll be sure to push that out. Are you shooting? Did you have a video for your new album? Any music videos?
Yeah. Yep, we do. We have about, I think, three slamming music videos. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, Speech, it's been great. I really appreciate it. I know it's been great hearing your background, your stories.
Hey, everyone. I want to thank you for being part of Halftime Chats. This new update is really about our membership, and I'm really excited to be able to fully launch the membership page. There will be things like full interviews from day one. As soon as the interview drops, you get access to it without any ads on it. There'll be some exclusive member-only videos that will just be some behind-the-scenes stuff and some other things that we will never be broadcast. For some members, you can be able to get actually two interviews, because I do have a backlog of almost seven or eight interviews that I don't even know when I'm going to be able to broadcast them. So you're able to get at least some of those up front, and some just behind the scenes stuff, because there's a lot of stuff that goes behind the scenes that I have never been able to talk about or release. For anyone else, you know what, the videos would still be the same over a week or a week and a half or 2 weeks, depending on how long it is. So everything stays the same. The polls stay the same. The community chats, the community stuff stays the same. But I think with the membership stuff, I'm able to add a little bit more and invest a lot more time and energy in really supporting the members. So I do hope you come on that ride with me. I appreciate the support. And this will just help me continue to invest in taking things to the next level. Take care. I begin to...